The Womanity Project. Let's talk about gender. Genders. Gender? Gender equality. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Womanity Project Live. I'm Aurélie Harp, and this is Geraldine. Hi, Geraldine.
Hi, I'm Geraldine Pearson, and you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Today, our guest is Nate Levin, former staff attorney at Save the Children, and also an amateur historian with a special interest in the U.S. women's suffrage movement.
A few weeks ago, I wrote a post in the Facebook not-so-secret-anymore group, Pantsuit Nation, offering the mic to anybody who wanted to speak out and continue the conversation about gender equality on the Womanity Project. And Nate raised his hand. Hello, Nate, and welcome.
Thank you so much, Aurélie. Thank you, Geraldine. I'm thrilled to be here.
Hello, Nate. So we always start our show asking our guests to introduce themselves. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from?
I grew up in upstate New York. I've lived in Westchester County in Rye, north of the city, for more than 30 years. I'm a lawyer. I'm married. My wife and I have a daughter who's a young adult living in Brooklyn.
Ooh, where about?
Not far from here, Bed-Stuy.
That's where we're from. Great.
We're not from there. We live there.
Yeah, we live there.
As you cannot tell.
Okay, and can you tell us a little bit when and how you started your interest in the U.S. women suffrage movement?
Well, I can start by saying that I'm a second-generation member of the League of Women Voters. My mom was active for many years, and the League of Women Voters grew directly out of the suffrage movement. So that kind of led to looking into the history and writing a book about the founder of the League of Women Voters, who was one of the leading suffragists of the early 20th century. This was about 25 years ago, and I went on from there to continue to study and expand my interest and knowledge of the suffrage movement.
Wow.
All right. So let's talk about the first wave of feminism. But before, we'd like to listen to the extract from the documentary One Woman, One Vote, created for PBS. It chronicles the 70-year struggle for women's right to vote, leading up to the passage of the 19th Amendment in the U.S. Senate by one vote.
"1913. Washington had never seen anything like it. "8,000 women... from all over the country, flooding down Pennsylvania Avenue, demanding the right to vote. It is absurd, said one delegate, half the citizens in America keeping the other half from the ballot. Inez Milholland. 3 years later, she'd die of exhaustion campaigning for the cause. One delegation, dressed as pilgrims, had marched 400 miles from New York City, led by General Rosalie Jones.
We are marching on to victory, coming in our might, for our cause is right. We are marching for...
The reaction from the crowd was mixed. Some men jeered. One yelled, "Go home to your mother." The marcher yelled back, "My mother is here." Women new to the battle, some who had fought for decades. By 1913, the movement had millions of supporters. But on that blustery day, there were few who could remember how it all began, 65 years before, in Seneca Falls, New York.
The 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution prohibits any United States citizen from being denied the right to vote on the basis of sex. It was ratified on August 18, 1920, passed in the U.S. Senate by one vote. Wow. Nate, can you tell us a bit more about that?
Right. Amending the Constitution is very difficult in the United States. You have to get two-thirds of the vote in both houses of Congress, and then you have to get three-quarters of the states to sign off, to ratify. So it's extremely difficult. And the suffragists were able to do it at last in the late 1910s, culminating in 1920. And they were able to do it because they had become a huge mass movement that was irresistible by the political establishment.
Great. Can you tell us more about that? Like, how did this movement grow?
I don't know how it became a mass movement. It's kind of a mystery. But there's evidence that there was a shift in public opinion toward suffrage around 1906 to 1910, and then things really took off from there, and it kind of became something that a lot of people were interested in, and more important, that many, many women were willing to rally around.
And who were the, I would say, the leaders of this movement?
Well, by the time the 20th century had come around, and we were in the 1910s, there were two most prominent leaders. And one was Alice Paul, who was the organizer of that parade in 1913, and who was the more militant wing of the movement, went off on her own soon after. And then there was Carrie Chapman Catt, who was the leader of the mainstream suffrage organization. And she didn't agree with a lot of the tactics that Alice Paul used. But she had, I've read, 1 million or 2 million members behind her, working in many, if not all, of the states. So that was kind of the mass of the local movement that really made this happen.
I would love to go back on the parade because there was this movie, I think it was an HBO movie.
Yes. So, Iron-Jawed Angels.
So they were in the street, like, wearing all these costumes, and it was, like, a very epic parade.
It was. It was designed to draw as much attention and press coverage as possible. It was held the day before Woodrow Wilson's inauguration for his first term. So a lot of press in town, a lot of people in town. And Alice Paul was the guiding genius of setting up that whole event, planning it to the smallest detail. But kind of the best thing that happened was there was almost a riot as it was going on, and that greatly increased the amount of publicity coverage and greatly increased the sympathy for the cause of suffrage. So it was a tremendously successful event, even though it sort of, or because it kind of went wrong to some extent. So it is an extremely difficult thing to accomplish, extremely difficult. And the women were only able to do it because they'd become an irresistible political force. They were a huge mass movement that the political establishment could not avoid, that the political establishment basically had to bow down to.
And would you say, I'm curious too, if World War One was in a way, had an effect on that, because women were going to work?
Certainly. It was a big, big factor. And women were drawn into war industries, were performing essential work for the war effort to go on. And the main suffrage organization, led by Carrie Chapman Catt, took the decision to back the war effort. It was a very controversial decision, but it made things easier for the president and kind of put the president in their debt politically. So he more and more became a supporter of their cause.
I'm going to have a cynical question. Do you think the politician in that time were more inclined to approve and be behind the movement as well in order to get those future votes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The political establishment was dragged into it. I mean, some were true believers, but many of them, including President Wilson, were kind of coerced or dragged into supporting it, and eventually became very supportive, but it was only because public opinion had been won by the mass movement that was the suffrage movement at that time.
After the Constitution was amended, what happened? What were the direct effect?
Well, it's interesting. Women got to vote. Women who had been denied one of the basic rights of citizenship were able to exercise that right, but it did not cause a political revolution in the country. It may have helped the Republicans win the election of 1920 because they were more supportive of suffrage than the Democrats were, although there were many Democratic supporters as well. But for many, many years, for decades, women voted more or less the same way men did. So the effects were subtle. They were not far-reaching, I would say.
But in terms of numbers, did women go to vote massively all of a sudden?
It took them time to kind of join the ranks of voters. Some did, of course, immediately. Some had been dying to start exercising that right. But I think for a few decades, the level of participation by women in voting was lower than that by men. They weren't in the habit. They needed to be educated. They needed to grow into their citizenship, I guess you could say.
If we can draw parallels between first wave feminism and feminism today, did the definition change?
I've only read a couple books about the second wave. I mean, we don't have that gate at the door of the voting booth to keep women out anymore. So we don't have that one thing for women to unify around. We are not currently, I would say, in a period of mass activism as there was in the 1910s and again 50 years later with the second wave. But who knows, perhaps we are at the beginning point of another wave of mass activism, which I think would be wonderful if it happens, if we can make it happen.
I was surprised by this election as well to see that, you know, all of a sudden, I guess Hillary Clinton was trying to, at the beginning, to not make it about women, because a lot of women appear to not, to really dislike her. And hearing all the time, I don't vote with my vagina, I vote with my head. But to see as well that so many women voted for a candidate that was discriminating women, I never realized that the question of women's right was so taboo, or like so many people were disagreeing on what
right,
it means
right.
to.
Tremendous divisions about it. And the United States is very divided and it's very complicated. And I'm not an expert on the United States as it is now. I mean, I think so many people have said so many things over the last year and a half where they made predictions and those predictions were wrong. And it shows that their understanding of what the country was all about and where the country was at was wrong. And I don't know. I think it is clear that for many women, their identity as people who are struggling economically or their identity as people who have a sense of protecting their identities as white people or their opposition to abortion or their concern about gun control, all of those things in many women's minds, I think, probably outweighed their sense their identity as women and a need to vote for a female candidate. So that's just my half-baked response to it.
Appreciate it.
The first wave of feminism, was it only women rallying to get the right to vote, or were they asking something else, or did they want equality as well in their everyday life or workforce or workplace?
Yes, there were other concerns, and they were successful in many ways through the 19th century and the early 20th century. And the vote was in some ways a symbol of greater recognition of women's status. But it's complicated. You know, when they took the kind of natural rights approach, are women people? If they're people, they should have the same rights as any person would have. That was not as successful. When they took the argument of we're wives, we're mothers, we need the world to be safe for our families, we need politics to be cleaned up, we need business to be cleaned up, we can't do that without a vote. It's part of our role as women and mothers to use our vote to make the world safe for our families. So not walking away from their separate identity as women, but really expanding it to include the public realm as well. That's where they really became more successful with their argument. It was a less challenging argument to the status quo and to what was in men's minds about what women were supposed to be.
So would you have any insight? And again, we're not experts. It's just like, as human being, like, what could be the one thing that rally men and women, and I would say feminists or people going for equal rights today? What could be the, because we have the vote, we have, and I guess every time you talk about it, a lot of people are like, things exist. Like, you know, you why would you need to fight more?
Well, things exist, but are things equal? I mean, I don't think so. You look at the Fortune 500, and only 5% of those companies are headed by women. 5%, that's ridiculously low. You look at the front page of the New York Times business section to see someone who's doing a big deal or taking home a billion-dollar paycheck. Almost never is that person a woman. I mean, no woman, of course, has ever been president. No woman has ever been governor of New York. No woman has ever represented the Senate, represented Connecticut or New Jersey in the United States Senate. Women are still so limited in their access to power. And there are so many other things. I mean, the world is not set up for working women. I mean, I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but there are many, many things. And I don't necessarily see a new wave that's only directed at one thing, but I see a new wave of if it happens, I hope it happens, a new wave of activism that is addressing many things, just as the second wave did. The second wave was not monolithic. There was a huge increase in activism and political involvement, but it took on many issues that were of concern to women, and many of those issues have not yet been resolved, and we are a long way from the society that we should have.
And we're going to leave you with a power song that Nate chose in memory of Elizabeth Reed from the Allman Brothers at Fillmore East.
Thank you.
listening to the Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn, and now we're gonna start with the Womanity Questionnaire.
All right. Well, I think the first one's an easy one for you, Nate. What is the gender you identify with?
Male.
And what are the attributes you give to that gender?
Yes, a much more difficult question. So, historically privileged and still privileged. Also, oriented more outside of the home than within the home, I would say. And there are exceptions.
Was there a day you were particularly grateful to be a man?
A month or two ago, I was giving a presentation for a community group, and my co-presenter was male. And we talked about ourselves a little bit, and I mentioned my interest in woman history. And everyone in the audience was female, and we two presenters were male. And my co-presenter kind of asked them to kind of recognize me for my extremely notable interest in women's history. So I felt proud, but I feel a little bit sheepish now because everyone should be interested in women's history. You know, I shouldn't get an extra gold star just because I'm a man and I'm interested in women's history. You know, it should be the same for everyone.
And on the opposite, is there a day when you were not particularly grateful of being a man?
When our daughter was born and I realized I was the breadwinner, I would be going off to the office, you know, 8-9 hours a day, and I was going to miss most of my daughter's childhood. I mean, I would be home for dinner, I would play with her, I would put her to bed, that kind of thing. I was very disappointed and sad that my gender role was going to be keeping me away from that experience, which I never had and could never have again.
Is there anything that you think should change regarding how gender is treated in our society?
Well, I think women should have much more access to positions of power. There should be many more organizations that are headed by women. I also think women and men are judged differently. You know, there are different sets of expectations. And somehow we need a new set of expectations that just apply to everyone, regardless of gender. I think there could be something else. I don't know what it is exactly. But I think it is somewhat gender limiting to have the primary definition of one's identity through what one's career is. I mean, that was, as I said, that was the trap that I was caught in when our daughter was born. And I think, you know, we've only seen the world of work and the business world eat up more of our lives over the last 30 or 40 years. And I think that's been bad for women. I would say let's push back against that. Let's reclaim the personal for both men and women to express themselves in a way that's not gender-based and that's not based on economic power.
And on a very more like a concrete and personal level, is there one positive change that you, as you, Nate, as a person, you can do to start to help another woman?
Yeah, I think so. I may not be able to do it immediately, but there's the division of work and responsibility within my household, and I'm looking forward to the time when I'll be working less, and I hope taking some more of the burden of the household off my wife, who also works outside the home. I mean, it's a complex problem to solve, but I would like to do more and do better in that direction.
And is there a woman you would like to thank?
My mom, for her example of activism, because she's been an activist for many years. She's in her late 80s now, and she is still an activist, and actually 8 years ago she became a legend for her activism and action she took with her political involvement. So she's an inspiration for me to aspire to increase my level of activism.
I have a quick question is, what about your daughter? Is she like a strong feminist?
I think she's very busy with supporting herself, and she has other interests, and I haven't really had the discussion with her. I don't know that I'd want to put her on the spot. I don't want to be the dad saying, well, you know, you have to be a feminist, because she has so many things she has to do. You know, I don't want to put a burden on her, but it's not something we talk about a lot, and my interest in women's history is not something that we particularly share. So she's like many women, she's very busy. She's not thinking about being a feminist, I think, most of the time.
And who is the next person, Nate, you would like to nominate to be interviewed?
Well, she's not local, so that could be a problem, but Professor Lisa Tetrault, who wrote the terrific book about Seneca Falls and how it came to be the touchstone that it is now.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn. And thank you very much, Nate, for being here today. It was really fabulous to have you here.
Well, I had a great time. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Nate. And we finish with our question of the week. With the last election, have we entered the third wave of feminism, or is feminism dead?
That's a very polemic. Maybe it's even the fourth wave of feminism. I have no idea. So you can like us and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Womanity Project. You can support us and sponsor us on our page, radiofreebrooklyn.com/show/the-womanity-project.
Special thanks to Nate Levin, Lizzie Hagstedt, and of course, Radio Free Brooklyn.
Tune in next week, The Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn, every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time.
The music written by Miles Davis, he calls So What?